Well,
my
no,
God.
it's a way of doing it, is I guess.
Oh, no, that's good. Well, I did actually pre-talk.
Oh, good, good, okay.
House Committee on Revenue for Monday, March 30th, 2015 will come to order. Colleagues, last week we ran out of time to hear the bill involving forest products, and we're going to hear that one now. So we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2455. Christine?
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2455 is the biennial forest products harvest tax bill. It extends privilege taxes on forest products that are harvested on the state's forest lands. It will set the tax rates for calendar years beginning January 1st, 2016 and January 1st, 2017. And there are a couple of different rates there. One would be for the purposes of administering the Oregon Forest Practices Act, and also funds that are transferred into the Forest Research and Experiment account, and also the Oregon University System Fund subaccount for professional forestry education.
Very good. Why don't we hear from the Department of Forestry and the College of Forestry first. Good afternoon. If you'd state your name for the record and then give your testimony, that would be appreciated.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Satish Upadhyay, Chief of the Administrative Services Division for the Department of Forestry, and here to testify in support of House Bill 2455. First, the Department of Forestry appreciates this opportunity to provide testimony in support of House Bill 2455. House Bill 2455 amends ORS 321.015 to establish the forest products harvest tax rates for calendar years 2016 and 17. These taxes support the Oregon State University Forest Research Laboratory, OSU Professional Forestry Education, and the Department of Forestry's administration of the Oregon Forest Practices Act. Now let me talk to you a little bit about the Oregon Forest Practices Act. This act is vital in assuring the public that private lands are managed with resource protections and that a stable regulatory environment exists for forest businesses. Enacted in 1971 and modified many times since, it regulates timber harvest, road construction and maintenance, treatment of slash, chemical use, and other practices on private lands. It also requires reforestation and scientifically supported best practices for all aspects of forestry, including stream protection, water quality, road construction, pesticide application, sensitive wildlife sites, and other resources. The Act encourages investment in private forest lands by providing a consistent regulatory environment. It also constitutes a social contract with the public, providing assurance that private forests are managed responsibly. The success of the Forest Practices Program depends on a shared responsibility and partnerships among stakeholders, forest landowners, operators, and other state agencies, and the department. The program gains compliance with the Forest Practices Act by maintaining an effective balance of science-based rules, incentives, technical assistance, and uniform enforcement. Now, for the Department of Forestry, this bill maintains the concept of shared responsibility between the general public and forest landowners for resource protection and benefits provided by the Act. This shared responsibility is reflected in the joint funding of the program by public funds and harvest tax revenues. As shown in Attachment 1, you should have a copy of my written testimony in front of you all. As shown in Attachment 1, Oregon harvest levels declined during the 1990s due to reduction in harvest from federal forest lands. Now, before that, the tax rates that are established by the bill are set on a per 1,000 board feet harvested basis. For comparison purposes, if you are driving on the road and you see a loaded log truck, on an average, that truck carries around 3,000 board feet of logs. And the rates are calculated considering three elements. One, the current biennial ending balance. Two, the projected budget requirements for the next biennium. And three, the forecasted harvest levels for the next 2 years. Now, if you refer to Attachment 1, Oregon harvest levels declined during the 1990s due to reduction in harvest from federal forest lands. As shown in Attachment 2, this resulted in rate increases as budget needs were spread across lower harvest volumes. Since 1999, harvest level had generally stabilized at approximately 4 billion board feet per year, and the tax rates had stabilized as well until the recent economic downturn when there was a decline in harvest levels because of drop in market demand. The 2009 harvest of 2.7 billion board feet is the lowest since the post-depression harvest of 2.6 billion board feet in 1934. The 2010 harvest increased slightly to 3.2 billion board feet. Harvest levels in 2011 and 2012 increased to 3.6 billion board feet. And in 2013, Oregon's timber harvest rose to 4.2 billion board feet, marking the fourth year of increase, reflecting the economic recovery that was taking place. We are currently anticipating harvest volumes for the next 2 years of approximately 4 and 4.1 billion board feet. How is this tax collected? The Oregon Department of Revenue collects the harvest tax and transfers the receipts to the Department of Forestry on a quarterly basis. At this time, we still have one of the 8 revenue transfers remaining in the current biennium, and we expect the transfer to take place sometime in May. Because the new tax rate in House Bill 2455 for the next 2 year period are based in part on the ending balance of the current biennium, we would suggest that rates not be inserted into the bill. In addition to the current biennium actual revenue consideration, the harvest tax is directly linked to the department's next biennial budget. Therefore, the rate calculations must remain fluid until the agency's budget bill is or at near completion. This requires a concurrent consideration of House Bill 2455 and the agency's budget bill, House Bill 5019, in the Joint Ways and Means Committee during the final legislative budget process. In summary, the Department of Forestry supports House Bill 2455 and welcomes the opportunity to work with the Legislative Assembly as the revenue and budget processes move forward. And thank you for your time and consideration, and we'll be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. My name is Thomas Manis. I'm Dean of the College of Forestry at Oregon State University, and I want to thank you for an opportunity to come here today to testify in support of House Bill 2455. I've submitted written testimony, so I think I'll just make a few comments about the things that that this funding supports at the college, and then I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have. The harvest tax payments to the College of Forestry is something that's unique in the United States that supports research. And the research that we do at the College of Forestry and the education that we do basically supports 5 functions at the college. One is the training of graduates for outstanding careers and the workforce training for companies that hire these graduates. Secondly, to provide unbiased research on relevant issues to forestry and to our forest economy. The third is to develop innovative ideas for solving some of the problems that we face and new ideas for expanding our economy. Fourth, extension programs to increase productivity. And fifth, continuing and professional education programs. I thought rather than go through a listing of all the research that we do, I might offer one idea that I thought of last Thursday as I was sitting listening to the testimony about climate change and carbon sequestration on Thursday. What I might tell you about a new technology that's being worked on at Massachusetts Institute of Technology called carbon capture and transfer. They're working on a technology to take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere or out of pollution that's going to the atmosphere, convert that into something else, and put it 7,000 feet underground to store that. And someday in the future, they think they may even be able to capture that carbon dioxide, convert it into something usable, and then actually use that. And I thought it was interesting because I wanted to tell you about a technology that we work on at Oregon State University that I think may bear fruit sooner than MIT's. And that is a carbon storage technology called, it's a project that we have called Sudotsuga Menziesii, also known as Douglas fir.
Exactly.
This technology actually takes carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, converts it into something usable, stores that, and then you can actually use that material that we call wood in a number of really innovative ways. And Oregon is actually the number one state in the United States for the production of this new thing called wood that helps us with this problem that we have, which is too much CO2 in the air.
Well, congratulations on your invention, and we assume you've reserved the intellectual property rights.
We have not. This is free licensing for the rest of the world. But I think it's really something that's really important and worth thinking about, because right now, architects and engineers around the world have determined that sustainable building materials actually must be used if we're really going to advance on our goals around climate change, mitigating climate change. And we're seeing in Asia, we're seeing in all through Europe, we're seeing in Australia the emergence of tall wood buildings as a new technology to help with that. The trouble is that in most of the Pacific Rim, Asia, Australia, there's a shortage of wood supply. And Oregon can supply sustainable buildings to the world. And by capturing CO2 and converting it to something useful and providing that. And that's one of the research items that we're currently working on, a new project that we have with the University of Oregon's College of Architecture in sustainable wood building design and manufacturing. But that's just one of the things that we're currently doing. That where I think Oregon can make a significant contribution without going through a lot of really major investments. Rural communities in the state absolutely depend on the forest products industry. I'm not telling you anything that you don't know. We have about 60,000 people that are employed in the forest products industry, and almost all of those are serving rural communities. And what we're working on at Oregon State University is really new ideas and new innovation that will help revitalize these rural communities by developing new manufacturing opportunities that sit on top of what we're already producing. We're already producing plywood. We're already producing lumber and those types of building materials. But what we're talking about now is combining those building materials into complete building systems that can be exported to the rest of the world. And we're exporting, remember, solid CO2 whenever we export one of those. Over the last 2 years, we've been working really hard at the College of Forestry. We've transformed the college by creating a new professional forestry school that offers our education program in the last 2 years, junior and senior year. We accept transfer students they can do their first 2 years anywhere in the state. This is designed to help with the cost of education and also to increase the field-based education that we have in our 2 years. We have the largest professional forestry program in the nation. We've created this new Institute for Wood Building Design and Manufacturing that I mentioned with University of Oregon, created a new research institute, the Institute for Working Forest Landscapes, that looks at how public land and private land work together. And we have a very strong fish and wildlife and managed forests research program. All of these things are funded by the harvest tax that supports both research and education. We wouldn't have a College of Forestry without that support, and I want to give my sincere thanks to the industry for continuing to provide this funding, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? You were very thorough. Thank you.
Thank you.
Roger Beyer, Christine McNutt.
Go ahead. Am I first?
Yep.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Christina McNitt, representing the Oregon Forest Industries Council. As you heard, House Bill 2455 is the perennial agency bill in front of you that sets the forest products harvest tax for the upcoming biennium. The current tax rate is $3.43 per 1,000 board feet and supports five programs that pretty much focus on education, regulation, and research. These include the Oregon Forest Resources Institute, Fire Protection, the Oregon Department of Forestry Forest Practices Act Administration, professional forestry education at the College of Forestry at Oregon State, as you just heard, and for the Forest Research Lab, also at the College of Forestry. Specifically, House Bill 2455 sets the rates for the latter three programs, which are tied to the budgets of both the Department of Forestry and the higher education budget, specifically the so-called OSU statewides, which are the Ag Experiment Stations, OSU Extension, and the Forest Research Lab. Unique among the 14 natural resource agencies, the Department of Forestry is not funded with permit fees, rather through this tax mechanism, which provides the landowners pay 40% of the cost of the Forest Practices Act Administration. I'm delighted that House Bill 2455 afforded you an opportunity to hear from the Dean of the College of Forestry, Thomas Manis. Since inception of the Forest Products Harvest Tax 30 years ago, the college has received dedicated funding for research to inform landowners and policymakers about the impacts of contemporary forest practices on landscapes and our environment. House Bill 2455 has come to you via the House Ag Committee. It has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. We would support moving the bill without recommendation to Ways and Means, where the respective agency budgets and corresponding tax rates will be calculated. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Roger Beyer here, representing Oregon Small Woodlands Association. So you've seen a graph that talks about the timber harvest in Oregon and who pays for those, or who are those harvests. You have the state, the federal, the counties, the government. You've got the large landowners. Well, my guys are the rest of them. So the small woodland owners, I believe about 15% of the harvest annually in the state. So it's not insignificant amount. You heard about all the wonderful things this tax goes to pay. We all or goes for. We also would support you moving the bill forward without a number in the blank at this point in time, because the tax has to be based on ending fund balances of the different programs and the amount of general fund that will be put into some of the other programs before we can come up with a final number to get the approximate match that has traditionally been used in these programs. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
This looks suspiciously like the bills that we've seen every 2 years. Is it?
It is identical to the bill you see every 2 years.
Right. And the point you make about filling in the blank, it does look like a number that has been created in order to fit with a different set of numbers, and that's exactly what you said. Okay. Any questions for this panel? Thank you so much for your testimony.
Thank
you. We appreciate it. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard today on House Bill 2455? If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2455, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2940. Kyle, go ahead and give us our introduction.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. So there's a document I'd call your attention to before I get into the description. Under meeting materials in OLIS, it's titled TEs with Reporting Requirement. So it'll help to list and explain what it is I'm going to talk about here in 1 second. But so what House Bill 2940 will do, and we do have a dash one amendment, so I'll get to an explanation of what that does in just 1 second. But the measure requires certain state agencies to provide certain information regarding businesses allowed certain property tax exemptions. Now, those certain exemptions are listed in that document I was alluding to in OLIS. But the information that's required is supplied to the Oregon Department of Administrative Services in each even-numbered year for posting on the Oregon Transparency website, and to the Oregon Business Development Department during each odd-numbered year. And then the bill requires OBDD, the Business Development Department, to report received information to the House and Senate Committees on Revenue during each odd-numbered regular session year. This would apply to property tax years beginning on or after July 1st, 2016. And the Dash 1 amendment, which we have in OLIS, the change it makes is requiring certain state agencies, it would require the Department of Revenue and the Legislative Revenue Office to provide the information to DAS and OBDD for posting the transparency website and also supplying that information to the two revenue committees. So that's the Dash 1 changes. And just without saying, on OLIS, that document, it does list, there is existing law that about posting the transparency website. So I've listed the different bills in the past that have passed and the tax expenditures and the ORS associated with those that are required to be on the transparency website. And House Bill 2940, at the bottom, you'll see there's two additions to what's currently two more tax expenditures essentially would go on the transparency website. And then there's a number of tax expenditures with new information that would have to be supplied under the requirements of this bill.
Very good. Well, hello.
Well, hello, Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. I'm Ann Leininger, State Representative for Lake Oswego and Southwest Portland, and I'm here in support of House Bill 2940 because I believe that if we want to make good policy, we have to have good information. And what this bill would enable us to do is to more clearly understand how much money we spend or tax revenue we forego based on incentives and tax abatements to support economic development and what we get in return for that, what the community benefit is that we get in return. This bill would apply to businesses, to already public information, to the property taxes of businesses that own over $10 million of real property in Oregon, so large businesses that choose to accept incentives from the state, and it would require gathering of information by LRO, as amended, LRO and the Department of Revenue, regarding the property taxes that the businesses pay, with the incentives they receive, what they would pay were they not to have received the incentives and abatements, the economic development, so the total amount we ultimately get, the number, what they are giving to the state in return for those abatements, the number of jobs that the business created or retained in exchange for the incentives, and then it would also require information about the nature and the duration of the jobs that have been created. The idea is, a lot of this information is available in bits and pieces. It's largely public information already, but what we lack is a really coherent narrative about what we're spending, what revenue we're foregoing, and what our community gets in return. This bill is intended to help us address that issue. And as we get ready to pass a school baseline budget, I think many of us who are concerned about wanting to have enough money to fund schools and knowing that we're 3 weeks fewer instructional time than the national average know that we need to be very sure that we're careful about the tax revenue we forego because that's money that we can't spend on schools. It's money we can't spend on other core services like human needs services and public safety services. And so as someone who wants to be able to steward our resources well, fund a full year for our kids, I think we need to be very careful to make sure that all the dollars that we spend or choose not to receive because of incentives and tax abatements are worth it. This bill would help us gather that information, and I hope you will support it.
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, thank you for allowing us to present this before you this morning. My name is Barbara Smith-Warner, and I am the representative from House District 45, Northeast Portland, Maywood Park, and Park Rose. I'm happy to be here with my colleague, Representative Leininger, here today, and not to repeat much of what she said, but just to elaborate on it a little bit. One of the other committees on which I serve is the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education, and one of the key things we really do there is budgets are presented before us, and we really spend a lot of time talking to agency directors, all of this, really drilling down on what are these expenditures that you, what is this money you're asking for? What are you doing with it? What kind of a return are we getting from it? And that really, the premise of this, this bill in particular and some other transparency bills is to really give us, is to keep in, to keep us focused on the expenditure part of tax expenditures, that indeed they are policy decisions, and we need to be able to assess how those expenditures are being used so that we can get a better sense of what, you know, how our policies are working or not working, what kind of returns we're getting. So in the same way we do that kind of information seeking in the ways and means side, this is the idea of trying to broaden that to the tax expenditure side because it has so much of the same impact on our budget. There are some a couple things. We mentioned that there's a dash one amendment already. Representative Leininger and I started with Business Oregon in this as a way to say, hey, you know, that's where we wanted to start with, was here, you're the place that is implementing in a lot of this. We've gotten a lot of great response and feedback from them on how best to do this. Other advocates who I some of them may be testifying today, but some of them have submitted testimony as well, have other proposals and suggestions about how this data is indeed put on. DAS, as a matter of fact, talks about the ability to just put stuff up on a website versus it being particularly usable. And I know some advocates are talking about the idea of having this information in a database form, in a kind of sortable, usable way, so that we can not just have a bunch of things pasted to a website, but actually have a functioning information source through which we can get good information about the impact of the legislation that we're passing. So with that, I will say I look forward to discussing this with all of you and continuing to move forward on this and other transparency ideas.
Thank you. Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you both for the bill and your testimony. I had two questions. One, it says in a couple of places in the bill, the number, type, and duration of jobs. I think I understand number. I think I understand duration. What do you have in mind by type?
Well, I think one issue is, are they construction jobs? Are they ephemeral jobs? Or are they permanent jobs? How long have they lasted? Are they clerical jobs? Are they engineer jobs? You know,
so these are
broad brush descriptions.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
Thanks. So these are more like SIC code kind of descriptions? And
you know, I can't definitively say that would be the way of responding to it, but do you have a suggestion? Is that where you're going?
Mr. Chair, I don't. I'm just curious what type meant, and I think I'm getting it as a distinction of the sort of activity that a person is involved in, that kind of thing. If I might, Mr. Chair, I have one other quick question.
Please, yes.
Thank you. The other is the language that says the duration of jobs created in the state by the taxpayer due to the exemptions, and I guess this is somewhere between a question and a comment. One of the things that has always struck me in the Revenue Committee and the Economic Development Committee is the difficulty and the number of factors that exist in any decision or economic result. A part of, I imagine, what motivates this bill is not just taking it for taking the taxpayer's word for it that these jobs wouldn't have existed but for the incentive, but on the other hand, it's very hard, I think, to connect a specific policy to an economic result. So that's one observation. I'd be interested if you have reactions to that.
Well, one thing I would say is it makes a whole lot more sense to me to give, say, $16 million in incentives, which I think perhaps we most recently have approved in the bill that we passed, Senate Bill 611. If those jobs are going to anyway, it makes a whole lot more sense to me to improve a bunch of incentives through revenue foregone if the reason we're doing it is to cause the creation of some jobs that will be of significant benefit to people in the community. If we're doing it incidental to, on a parallel track from, successful work that a business is undertaking, then it doesn't seem like we would be getting as much value from that expenditure. And so I really think it is important to have someone make an assertion of causal relationship between the expenditure and the good thing that happened, because if the expenditure of tax resources doesn't cause the good outcome of the jobs being created, then I'm not that interested in doing it. I'd rather spend it on something that causes a good outcome.
Thanks.
Representative Davis, please. No? I guess you asked his questions. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes.
I'll see you soon.
Josie Kerner, Russell Gondereau, Bill Olson, please.
Garrett Rosenthal.
Can you call them?
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, you did. Okay, please.
Thank you.
Is that all right with you?
Yeah. He's an ally, so we don't. So we're going to go from.
I just got here a few minutes. I'm a minute late, so I apologize for that.
So, Chair Barnhart and members of the committee.
It's often difficult for me to figure out what panels to do, so
yeah, no,
I actually appreciate an interruption like this so we can get the panel straightened out.
Yeah, we're going to go from Garrett to Josie to me.
Thank you.
Chairman Barnhart, Vice Chairman Benz, members of the board of the committee, House Committee on Revenue. My name is Garrett Rosenthal. I'm a representative with the Taxpayers Return on Investment Coalition, TRIA is what we call it. I'm also associated with Onward Oregon, and I'm a former candidate for House District 37. And I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 2940, which calls for the standardized reporting of property tax exemptions. TRIA is a group of just lay citizens that we've gotten together. We've been working for about 18 months trying to develop similar concepts having to do with the benefit that we get from tax expenditures, and including property tax property tax expenditures that we get, and trying to track that and make it more transparent and more standardizable and easier for people to understand. In my testimony, government is not a business, but some principles of good business, particularly regarding investment, should be a model for government actions. I'm speaking of the investment in taxpayer revenues, which are my revenues and which are your revenues, and we should be careful about how we expend them, and we should get something for our return. Now, not all investments always work out the way we want, but nonetheless, we should be very prudent and do something wise with those. And that, you know, this is the kind of information that I try and get when I make private investments in businesses. We believe that it's good to invest in business. It's good to invest in jobs. It's good to invest in some cases things that provide infrastructure. It isn't always just measured by the number of jobs. It's measured by other things. But this is the kind of wisdom that we should do. HB 2940 is an important first step. It provides for posting of standardized critical information. Standardization and transparency are two of the key items. It seems natural and proper that we should do this. It seems something we should do with our public money. This kind of information is what we ask for when we invest in personal stuff. It's a good idea, but I think some suggestions for its improving its usefulness, and I'll leave it to the committee to figure out exactly the wording, but first would be a suggestion that it be expanded to all the agencies and to all public entities, not just state agencies, at least where those situations where state general fund revenues are impacted directly or indirectly. I think this would be a simple change of wording, just expanding it. The second addition would be a stipulation that the data is submitted to DAS in a standardized format. You might call it a unified format developed by DAS. In other words, so you have the same information from all sectors, whether it's something that's subject to potential recovery from gain share or something like that. So you have a unified database. Appreciate knowing that there's and I think that this is something that would be appreciated not only by the people using the website, but also by the people who are submitting it, because then they know they have a standardized format. The third suggestion would be the creation of an administration fee taken as a percentage, perhaps, of the tax exemption, whatever the exemption might be, and I don't know the number. It could be anywhere from 1% to 4%, perhaps. That would allow DAS, at a revenue-neutral form, to create these standardized formats and work on the process. They have the ability, they have the skills, they just don't have the budget to do this. And finally, posting is good, but we think there's something a little bit more would be required in a bill like this, and that would be, in the long run, some audit function. Again, this could be paid for with the administration fee. So it's something that the larger investments, and there would be time, you know, it's legislative intent to say, you know, where these start and how often it would be. We're not, I'm not an expert on the finances to say what that should be. But so I think those kinds of suggestions would broaden it and make the investments that we make for the people of Oregon more fair and more transparent. Thank you.
Okay, Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Benz, and Vice Chair Vega Pedersen. My name is Josie Kerner. I'm from Washington County. I'm also a member of the Taxpayer Return on Investment Coalition, and we'd like to testify in favor of 2940, which calls for reporting of business property tax exemptions. As Good Job First states, property taxes are sometimes the largest tax a company pays, which means property tax abatements can be the most lucrative subsidy they receive. In order to fully understand the costs and benefit of economic development, it is critical to have access to this data. Yet very few cities, counties, or states aggregate this data and make it available online. And I would hope that certain information in this bill means the annual reports that include total amounts of all taxes paid and all abatements provided to individual businesses and the total amount, which I think is in, you just put it, you clarified in the amendment. I would just like to say that, you know, our group, there's a number of tax bills that we support. And we've also developed our own, the Taxpayer Return on Investment Bill, which is 2087, hasn't been heard yet. But we also support 2077, 2165, 2630, and 2940. They all, in a combination, do what our 2087 does. And we would like to say that we would like to see a few things be in this bill, which is a great bill. Beside the property tax reporting, we think that recipient employers should be submitting an annual report to granting bodies, and that the granting bodies publish these reports annually and directs them, the body of, or the Department of Revenue, to reduce or recapture the subsidy for noncompliance. So we get a clawback. And then we feel that it would be good to have independent audits, which Garrett has explained is just a small proportion of the subsidy be withheld in order to get good tracking. So we feel that if we're going to give away millions of dollars in tax subsidies to private corporations, why wouldn't we not reserve some of that money to fund the mechanism to track them? So a little bit more about the tracking system. Basically, it's something we would hope we'd get very good requirements document about what this tracking system would do. But basically, there's certain questions it would answer. It's not putting everything under the sun in there. It's basic important information. How many subsidies does each parent or recipient employer receive? How much is each subsidy worth? What are the defined subsidy goals, and which metrics are used to determine whether the goals of the subsidy are met? If a subsidy goal is for job creation, has the level of employment increased, and by how much each year? So you start with in answer to Rep. Reed's question, you start with the baseline, has it increased, and by how much? At least you get some idea that there's been some tracking for that subsidy. Are the pay and benefits at or above the current pay standards for the industry and for that geographic area? So these are the this kind of tracking shouldn't require the you ought to be able to go to one website and see this research by doing certain sorts on the data. And you can sort by company, you can just sort by the kind of the agency or by the kind of the program. You ought to be able to just sort and see listed. And it's not, if you develop the form in advance and each agency knows what they're reporting, the recipient employer knows what we need to report, it's all going to come in into this one database, and you can sort that way. And this way you get your accounting figured out easily, and it's built in, and it's paid for. It's revenue neutral.
Okay, my name is Russ Dondero. I live in Forest Grove, and I'm down here regularly. Many of you talk with many of you, as we have. In fact, our committee has talked with every member of the Revenue Committee and or your staff, sometimes more than once. We've also vetted this idea with TED, the Economic Development Committee on the House side, because it's also the House, the bill, the location of our 2087 bill, which was the original inspiration after 18 months of hard work looking at possible national models, which we then put into an Oregon model that we created. But in looking at the bills that are before you right now, particularly this bill, 2940, but also HB 2077, which we testified ever so briefly in a hearing in this committee, and HB 2630, we decided rather than to reinvent the wheel, we feel that those three bills combined accomplish what we wanted to accomplish in 2087. And so, you know, we have basically suspended our discussion about that omnibus bill because I think, you know, better go with the train engine that's going out of the station rather than try to catch it, you know, in another train that who knows where that may end. So to use that metaphor, I'm an old train guy, so that's where I'm coming from here. So we have vetted this idea for over a year and a half with many of you and many other people in this building, both in the legislature but also private and public groups who are interested in this kind of concept of transparency. And so we also get a sense that this is a bipartisan issue. Representative Davis and other people have, on the Republican side as well as the Democratic side, proposed various forms of transparency bills. And so we feel that there's a consensus here emerging that we need to do something. And I would prefer to take concepts that are laid out in House Bill 2940, because I think they're well thought out and they've been articulated very well by the two proponents this afternoon. So I have taken the liberty, and you should have this in front of you, of putting the language of our amendments in the specific format of the current bill as proposed as friendly amendments. And so I'm presumptive that I'm as smart as anybody as legislative counsel is, which, of course, as a political science professor, one may have a jaundiced opinion about that. I never practiced law, but in that, again, politics and law are so close. So I've tried to help pursue the process and push it along by looking at the law as the bill as proposed and our suggested amendments with suggested language that fits into the current bill rather than tries to reinvent the wheel. I think the most significant changes in the bill are our additions under Section 1, Line 14, Page 3, which refers to the Secretary of State and its audit function, and then the administrative fee, because we do not want the people of Oregon to bear through the general fund an additional administrative cost. We think, you know, if you get a SIP, if you get an enterprise zone, if you get a tax credit, seems to me, particularly if you're a global corporation like Intel, Nike, whatever, you know, you have the ability through these programs to put into some auditing mechanism and to finance it through your SIP or enterprise zone agreements with the state of Oregon and Business Oregon. So we're trying to create a responsible auditing process that's revenue neutral to the taxpayer of Oregon. Okay. So with that in thought, I will end my comments by saying again, we strongly support House Bill 2940, as well as the other bills that are in the hopper, and we are very pleased that there's a conversation in this building on both sides of the House and the Senate, as well as on both sides of the political aisle. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Now we'll go to Mr. Olson. David Gerling and Marcia Kellum. Kelly, please.
Good Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart, members of the House Revenue Committee. My name is Bill Olson. I live in Salem, Oregon. I'm a co-chair of the House or the Human Services Coalition Tax and Revenue Committee, and we are here on behalf of the Human Services Coalition, an organization of about 100 organizations and individuals that deal with or deliver services and advocate for revenues for those services as well. I'll be very brief. We support House Bill 2940. I think the presentation by the representatives Liniger and Smith Warner were right on and describe why we want this bill. And I really don't have anything in detail to add to what they've said, so I'll close my testimony and hear from others. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is David Jorling. I'm a resident of the city of Lake Oswego, and I'm serving currently on the board of the Oregon Rail Heritage Foundation, the Rail Museum. I am a retired attorney and spent most of my 40-year legal career in public service litigating on behalf of taxpayers. I have often had questions about the cost versus benefit of providing tax incentives to businesses while recognizing the need for a balanced approach to enable businesses to locate and grow in Oregon. According to the Economic Development of Central Oregon, or EDCO, website, and I quote, "Oregon consistently ranks among the lowest cost states for businesses, according to independent research organizations such as Forbes, Ernst & Young, the Tax Foundation, and the American Institute for Economic Research. In addition to this distinction, the state has more tools and incentives encouraging job growth and investment than any of its neighbors, including Washington, California, Idaho, and Nevada. Through incentives, Oregon offers to employers that qualify a virtually tax-free operating environment, both in the short and long term." And end of quote. My concern is providing a virtual tax-free environment to businesses while ranking 47th among the 50 states in funding higher education, a balanced approach. Attached to my written testimony is a list of Oregon tax incentives listed in the EDCO website. Look at the Oregon Trade Promotion Program, or STEP for short, fourth from the bottom on the first page. This program provides taxpayer-funded reimbursement for up to $5,000 of international trade show costs. Is that one really necessary? The federal deduction for business expenses isn't enough. I wonder, do businesses claim the federal deduction for the expenses paid by Oregon taxpayers? Taxpayers and businesses demand transparency in government, and rightly so. There are a number of ways to accomplish that. One example is that notices are posted in some road construction projects that inform taxpayers that the construction is funded by a certain amount of tax revenues. When a taxpayer enters a business or logs onto a business website, should not a similar notice be required of a business that informs the consumer that this business is funded in part by a 100% property tax exemption for 15 years at the cost of the taxpayer, say, of $1.5 million or whatever the cost is? I recognize that such a requirement would be politically impossible, but there should be mechanisms in place to see if government tax incentives are worth it. And in my view, this House bill accomplishes that task. One of the interesting things about our society is that in many areas, the more important work that one does, the less they are paid. In my profession, for example, the most important lawyers are prosecutors. They are the only lawyers that walk into a courtroom with the ethical obligation to do justice. No lawyer of any type should be paid more than them, yet they are among the lowest paid. The same is true of teachers. This is the most important profession of all, for without them we would not have doctors, business professionals, scientists, CEOs, engineers, plumbers, or carpenters. Yet teachers are frequently belittled in our public discourse and criticized for the wages they are paid. Attached to my written testimony is the salary scale for Portland Public Schools. I am informed that the typical starting salary for teachers, which are usually hired with a master's degree, is $45,030 a year, the number circled in my exhibit. I recognize that the wages listed do not include retirement and benefits, but $45,930 for a starting teacher with a master's degree is all we can afford. In my opinion, all those numbers in that sheet should be doubled. House Bill 2940 needs to be passed so that we can determine if all the incentives awarded businesses so they can operate, quote, virtually tax-free, unquote, are worth the low wages we pay our public servants. Finally, if I may be so bold as to suggest an amendment which arises from my 40 years of litigation, it strikes me that determining the number of jobs created due to tax incentives may be subject to argument and debate. I suggest that lines 28 and 31 of page 2 of the bill, the words due to be replaced by the word after and add the words are granted after the word subsection. It may be just better to get the hard numbers. Thank you for your courtesy.
Thank you, sir.
Chair Barnhart and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the lobbyist for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. After hearing the testimony from some of the previous testifiers, they've taken up some of the things that I would suggest, like a standardized form for companies when they're asking for any sort of tax abatement, and consistency in how we look at jobs. Full-time, average salary, part-time, construction duration jobs, if you're looking for jobs, so that we know and we can compare apples and oranges. It would be nice if we had this, because then it might possibly get us ahead of the game for state and local governments. GASB, the General Accounting Standards Board, in December put out a letter and that said beginning in 2017, those interested in incentives and abatements, expenditure spendings, will have access to significantly more data, because the General Accounting Standards Board is going to require local and state governments to list the deferred taxes in their audit report with quite a bit of information. The tax being abated, criteria that must be met for the taxpayer to be eligible for the abatement, provisions for the recapturing abated taxes, the types of commitments made by tax abatement recipients, numbers of tax abatement agreements, dollar amount of taxes abated, and other commitments made by a government, such as to build infrastructure. Oregon is not alone in looking for transparency. We have been asking for transparency since I started in this building in 2001. I think that putting the onus on the agencies to do the compilation is not correct, and so I think that being able to have LRO and DOR, as is suggested in the amendments, be good. But there should be a standardized form for any tax abatement, be it property tax or income tax, for an amount over a certain amount. We're not going to want those statements for little tiny tax things like the refrigerators or the more efficient stoves. But for anything that is substantial, we should have it, because these are not necessarily general fund dollars, but they're dollars that help the governments in Oregon provide the services that Oregonians need. So if we go for this bill, it will maybe actually put our entities in a better position to be able to adhere to the Government Accounting Standards Board. I know everybody has to do it when we get the audit for the transit district on whose board I serve. It's with a letter from RCPA that these meet the General Accounting Standards Boards, and I believe that's required.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you so much. We appreciate your testimony. Mr. Phillips.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. The department is neutral on this bill. We don't have a position. But if you ask us to report information, we want to be able to do it accurately and correctly. and completely. I have five comments about challenges this bill might bring, including my brief read of the amendments. First of all, the statute currently provides that if we have the information available, I think on page one of the bill, if I can refer to page one, line 19, it says, the following information, if it is already available in an existing database. That language for this particular bill changes for the new language on page two to the department shall report. So it moves it from a if it's available to we shall report. So in some ways, in some respects, it's having us collect information we currently don't, that's maybe not collected anywhere. And so we'd like to think long and hard about how we might do that. Secondly, it refers to property of the taxpayer that's directly or indirectly owned. And we're not sure where that information would be held, where the information on indirectly. It also talks later in the bill about property the taxpayer controls. And again, we're not sure where we'd get that, but maybe that's something we can learn more about and work with others on finding. It also refers in the bill later on to the state of origin for the people that are newly employed. And perhaps this is something the companies could help us with, because we wouldn't necessarily know where people were moving from. Representative Reed brought up a question we also had regarding whether or not it's a direct consequence of the exemption that the company is hiring these employees. So we're not sure if there's a causal relationship there, but that might be able to be clarified. And finally, the confidentiality issue. Much of what we see here we don't think would present a confidentiality problem. To the extent there's a concern about proprietary information, there are statutes that prohibit us from revealing confidential information from anything that comes from a return. I just checked with the office, and we have annual training. I think disclosure for us is like a Class C felony and termination from the department for at least 5 years. Personally, I'm kind of looking forward to the termination part, but I really don't want it to be as a result of a Class C felony. But in all seriousness, I think it would just we would be in a position to make sure that everything we released was lawfully being released, and that means we would be taking a very careful look at everything. And I know you want us to do that, and we would be. So those are my comments on some of the challenges, and I'm sure we can work those out.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Leininger, please.
Thank you so much, Mr. Phillips. You know, I'm really glad to hear input on ways that you think this bill could be made stronger or more easy to administer, and I would love to work with you to try to identify amendments that you think would help that get accomplished. I know that we, as we were working to develop the language originally, we consulted closely with some folks in the Department of Revenue to try to incorporate suggestions on things that would make it as administrable as possible, and one of those elements was to keep to property tax information as opposed to corporate income tax information, on the suggestion that as already, you know, the assessed value of property and then the property taxes paid, I guess, are both already public records. So hopefully that eases the concern that you might otherwise feel, or we can work together to get to a place where you feel comfortable with maintaining confidentiality that needs to be maintained while helping the public know what it is we're spending our money on, and if it's a good value given the universe of other things that we could be buying, which is, of course, something we all care about.
Precisely, and I couldn't agree more. Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions for Mr. Phillips? Well, I would simply note that it looks like the proponents of the bill have a little more work to do, and we look forward to seeing it when you've got it done.
Okay.
Anyone else who want to be heard today on House Bill 2940? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2940. We're moving now to our information meeting, Interagency Compliance Network Report. Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back in 2009, this committee approved a bill that established the Interagency Compliance Network. And one of the requirements of the bill was sponsored by Representative Holvey, Mayor Paul. one of the requirements of the bill was to for the departments involved to issue a report on the network's activity, and you received that report, came to you in February, and it's to your individual offices, but we also thought it would be good to hear from the participants, and they put together a presentation for you. Both the Employment Department and the Department of Revenue are the two most active members of the network, and they have a presentation for you.
Very good. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Galvin. I'm the Withholding and Payroll Tax Section Manager at the Department of Revenue. I have been actively involved with the Interagency Compliance Network, both steering committee and enforcement groups, since 2009. This afternoon, Isabel and I are here to provide a high-level summary of our report on the 2013 through 2015 activities and impact of the Interagency Compliance Network. Before we begin, I'd like to provide some background information on the Interagency Compliance Network. In 2009, the effects of the economic slowdown were adversely impacting the construction industry, and the contractors were aggressively competing for a greatly reduced number of jobs. The House Consumer Protection Committee heard testimony from several contractors who claimed they were losing jobs to contractors who were not playing by the rules. Their chief complaint and frustration was that the state was not doing enough to enforce laws related to worker safety, insurance, minimum wage, and tax compliance, and that this was creating an unlevel playing field. For example, a business that uses independent contractors does not pay the Social Security and Medicare taxes on behalf of their employees. They do not pay unemployment insurance or workers' compensation, so they're able to underbid their competitors who do follow the law and pay those taxes. Our initial calculations indicate a non-compliant contractor could obtain a 5% advantage by reporting employees as independent contractors. In response to requests to leveling the playing field, the 2009 legislature created the Interagency Compliance Network to improve compliance with Oregon's tax and employment laws. The ICN is made up of 7 state agencies, and its mission is to coordinate enforcement efforts, share information, and educate the public on worker classification. The objective of the Interagency Compliance Network is to create a level playing field for businesses. Employers who misclassify as independent contractors save nearly $5 per 100 spent on payroll, which allows the business to operate with lower expenses and subsequently underbid competitors. Worker misclassification contributes to underfunded worker benefits, tax avoidance, unfair wage practice, and puts business and individuals who obey the law at a disadvantage. Isabel will now describe the ICN functions, strategies, structure, and funding.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Isabel Jocelyn. I'm the Deputy Administrator of the Unemployment Insurance Tax Program with the Employment Department. That's a very long title. So, the functions of the ICN, primarily the ICN was focusing on the misclassification of workers. However, through the years now that we've been operating, we're also looking at the cash payment issues that we may be having with employers when they pay under the table, and so therefore avoiding paying taxes. We're also looking at identifying some of the obstacles that we may have, the employees may be having, on voluntary compliance with the tax laws in our state, and then, of course, the taxation of some of the revenues and the payroll taxes that they have to pay. On the next slides, I'm going to be talking to you about the strategies, the structure, the resources, and the funding that we have. We have 4 strategies that we follow. The first one is education and outreach, and that is the emphasis that we have at the ICN. We're trying to provide information to employers so they can be voluntary compliance with the tax laws. We have the criminal prosecution. We have that strategy available, but that's something that we don't focus on because we try to work with employers ahead of time. We're trying to be proactive and positive, and rather than following with the Department of Justice to get criminal prosecution. The other strategy that we follow is the data lead sharing, and that is the heart of the ICN. The ICN, with the seven agencies that participate, the focus is to sharing information and leads so we can work together to help employers be compliant with the law. We have also the super auditors as a different strategy that we have, and our super auditors, what allow us to do is they develop investigation methods, and they can be, and those investigation methods can be applied consistently when we do the audits, and we do joint audits. And basically with the joint audits, you may have one auditor, but they're looking at the records of several programs. So rather than having an auditor from the Department of Revenue, an auditor from DCBS, and an auditor from employment, we have one that looks at all of the records and work closely with other agencies in order to make sure that they are in compliance with the programs. On the organization and the structure, we have two major committees that work on ICN. One is the steering committee. The steering committee meets on a quarterly basis, and we make sure that we give direction to the enforcement group and address any issues that other state agencies or executive staff or the legislative committee have getting information from the ICN. In addition to that, we have the ICN enforcement group, and the enforcement group is actually the doers. They meet on a monthly basis, and what they work on discussing the specific cases, allowing them to actually share information about companies and to the leads, and then also to develop collaborative audit strategies. So when we go and work with employers, we don't only audit their books, but we also try to educate them on some ways that they can use in order for being compliant in the future. These two groups are very cohesive groups. We work really well together. For example, the Department of Revenue, Employment Department, and DCBS, we're currently working on reviewing one of the major tools employers have to use on a quarterly basis to file their payroll reports. So we're going to be looking at the process. We're going to be looking at the actual reporting tool and all the information that they need to have at hand when they need to do their reports. Resources and funding. All the ICN agencies have staff that are not ICN-related staff, that they do use the concept of the ICN when they're doing their day-to-day activities. So just because they don't have ICN-dedicated resources doesn't mean that they don't do the ICN work. Department of Revenue and the Employment Department have dedicated staff for the ICN. Group. We have two super auditors, and they work very close together when they're doing audits related to the ICN work. In addition to that, the Employment Department, we apply and were granted a $500,000 one-time grant from the Department of Labor. And what these funds are going to allow us to do is to help us hire additional staff and use some of the resources to create a little bit more of outreach programs and education to the employers, and hopefully allow us to develop some tools that we can use in order to see how we can help employers be in compliance with the law. And I'm going to turn it over to John to talk to you a little bit about the results of the ICN.
So the results this biennium are substantial by the number of investigations completed, misclassified workers, and the amount of underreported wages that were discovered. During the biennium, the Employment Department and the Department of Revenue were also able to successfully enter into an agreement to share federal tax information with the Internal Revenue Service. This agreement makes it possible to analyze state and federal information and produce leads of potential misclassification of independent contractor. Of the businesses that the Interagency Compliance Network has examined that remain open in 2015, over 85% of those businesses filed all four quarters for 2014. Based on their 2014 payroll tax filing, we're expecting more than $2 million from those businesses in returns filing for 2015. Although it's easy to identify revenues generated for the general fund, there are also intangible benefits of the Interagency Compliance Network. As it's grown in experience and partnership, the industries and communities that have been investigated and audited provide opportunities to spread the word and knowledge that the Interagency Compliance Network exists. These benefits enhance and improve voluntary compliance with the existing population, and as Oregon continues to experience growth, the efforts will continue to yield positive results for businesses operating in the state.
So our upcoming plans, now that we have the grant that we received from the Department of Labor, we hired an additional ICN auditor, and she's right now currently being trained and working with our more experienced auditors, so the ICN. We are increasing our outreach efforts. We have hired an additional person that is working closely with other ICN agencies, especially the Department of Revenue. So we are attending as many associations where we can outreach to employers to say, what do you need? What can we provide you? We are updating the website, and we are refining some of the tools that we are going to be using to get to track all of our all the results that we're doing by hiring the additional staff. We are using what we call the business intelligence tool at the Department of Employment, together with the, now that we have the data agreement with the Department of Revenue, then we're gonna be using some of their tools to gather some of the information. On the continuing coordinated efforts, we will continue to work together. There is three major areas that we are going to be focusing on. One is continue to share the information, because that is the heart of the ICN. You know, seven agencies working together to make sure that we are not just going in seven different people after an employer to review their records. So having one. The efforts are to promote collaboration between agencies as a matter of it's a culture change. You know, it. Generally, agencies just kind of individually is like, well, employment, I'm going to be looking only at unemployment tax and then Department of Revenue. So we're trying, that's a shift to us. So seven of us are working together to get us into move together. Our businesses are a little bit different, but we're trying to find those common areas where we can work together. And developing a coordinated audit plan, that is a key. When we go in, our super auditors actually look at all the records, not just employment, not just Department of Revenue plans, but all of the different payroll taxes that employees need to pay. And with that, we conclude our sharing of information with you, and if you have any questions, John and I will be more than glad to answer them.
Thank you very much. Questions? I have a couple of comments that I think. First, thank you very much for the report. I appreciate it. I remember very well the work that was done, I think, primarily by Representative Holvey,
yes,
but actually many other people were also involved in it, to get us to adopt what seems like a pretty obvious idea now, which is when you find businesses having trouble complying with one section of our laws, they might also have difficulty with a different section. And I think your work demonstrates that pretty well. Another comment I'd make, unless your auditors are extremely well paid, they're producing a substantial net income for the state of Oregon that it would not, or deposits into the various trust accounts that would not otherwise happen were it not for this program. And finally, my last comment, I thought you were extremely polite in the way you refer to compliance issues. But the reality is that word does get around, doesn't it? And that when people understand that the other business down the road that used to cut corners got caught doing it and had to pay up, they're less likely to cut corners and more likely to comply with the state's laws and provide the benefits that their employees are entitled to under that law. Anything else? Thank you so much. We very much appreciate the report. With that, colleagues, we have exhausted our agenda for today, and we'll see you all tomorrow. The committee is adjourned.